You're listening to The Hour of the Time, and I'm Pooh.
And I'm William Cooper.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. And good night, folks, and God bless you all.
Thank you, dear.
You're welcome.
Well, folks, I hope that you're all ready. I hope you have pen and paper. Remember, never listen to this broadcast without pen and paper, because you never know what you're going to hear. You're going to want to take notes tonight, ladies and gentlemen. I guarantee that. And if you can, you're going to want a tape recorder to record this broadcast. I want to make a statement here first, though. I received a fax from the militia of Montana today, and it seems that for once they're doing something right. Absolutely. I'm going to read this fax to you. They're absolutely correct here. They're doing it right. In this instance, I have to say that they're right on the money. They're doing a good job, and we got to support this statement. here it is. It has come to our attention that many concerned patriots are considering coming to the state of Montana for the purpose of sending the FBI home and freeing the freemen. This message is for the purpose of making you aware of what to expect when you enter our great state. One, all vehicles of a suspicious nature bearing out-of-state license plates will be stopped and searched. Two, all telephone conversations are being routed through Billings, Montana. Three, you will not find a militarized police action in operation against the freemen. Remember, this was the number one purpose for the formation of militia organizations across America, and it's working. The government is towing the mark. They're not doing what they used to do, at least not in this instance. They may be doing it somewhere else, but not in Montana. Area ranchers were and are still prepared to handle the matter themselves if the FBI would not or cannot take care of it. And for that story, read the next issue of Veritas, which we have purposely held up to make sure that we can give you as much of the facts as we can garner about this incident happening in the state of Montana. As stated in number three, there is no militarized police action. However, we are fairly certain military forces, amount unsure, are on standby if the FBI becomes surrounded by freemen supporters. We repeat, this is not a militarized police action. This must be understood by all. If you do come to Montana, understand that you may have more opposition from the local citizens than you will from law enforcement. And I can tell you that that's true, because I've talked to a lot of those people. Also, Montana law declares in Montana Code 45-8-106, bringing armed men into the state. One, a person commits the offense of bringing armed men into the state when he knowingly brings or aids in bringing into the state an armed person or armed body of men for the purpose of engaging in criminal or socially disruptive activities or to usurp the powers of law enforcement authorities. And two, a person convicted of the offense of bringing armed men into the state shall be imprisoned in the state prison for a term not to exceed 10 years or be fined an amount not to exceed $50,000 or both. That law, ladies and gentlemen, comes from the old range wars when ranchers used to hire gunmen from out of state and they used to bring them in and make their own law. The Militia of Montana requests, one, that you have all of your people pressure the Justice Department into returning Leroy Schweitzer to Montana from Missouri. Until this happens, we do not believe any freeman will surrender from the Clark Ranch. Would you? U.S. Attorney Sherry, what do you mean, would you? That's the only thing on here I don't understand. From our investigation, ladies and gentlemen, these people are clearly committed criminal actions against their own neighbors right there in Montana. Of course, that will all come out in a court of law. I'm not saying that they're guilty of anything, but our investigation shows us that they're not who and what you think they are. And I think that's going to be proven. U.S. Attorney Sherry Matucci, who is responsible for the action, may be reached at 406-657-6101, fax 406-657-6055. And I can't read that word. Two, that your energies be placed upon the judicial system to ensure that these men are given fair trials. The Randy Weaver siege and the Gordon Selner standoff are just two of many cases where they would not have occurred if the judicial system could be trusted. This is where your energies are needed the most. If you still feel the need to enter Montana, please heed the above warnings. For further information, please contact the Militia of Montana. And they're right on with that statement. First time I've ever seen anything come out of them that was right on that I could support. And I'm really happy to see it and happy to be able to support it. Okay, don't go away. I'll be right back. Remember, if you've got any socialists anywhere near you, get them in your living room to hear this broadcast. If you can't get them in there, tape it. Make a copy of the tape and give it to every socialist you know. It'll frost them. Ladies and gentlemen, Marx and Engels are customarily depicted as admirers of Abraham Lincoln, resolute foes of chattel slavery, and courageous champions of Negro rights, Negro equality, and Negro freedom. There is scarcely an iota of truth in this interpretation. Publicly and for political reasons, both Marx and Engels posed as friends of the Negro. In private, they were anti-black racists of the most odious sort. They had contempt for the entire Negro race, a contempt they expressed by comparing Negroes to animals, by identifying black people with idiots, and by continuously using the opprobrious term nigger in their private correspondence. If you're black and you're a socialist, make sure you listen very carefully to this, because it was the concept of freedom that exists among the people in this country and the document known as the Constitution for the United States of America that really set the black man free. You've been lied to for so many years, it's unbelievable you're still being lied to. Since Marx and Engels wrote to each other in German, they inserted the offensive English word instead of using the correct German word, which is spelled N-E-G-E-R. Since neither revolutionary theorist had much interest in the Negro, and still less in the fate of Africa south of the Sahara, the quest for Marx and Engels' true views on the Negro has required quite a diligent and prolonged search. It has been rewarded if that is the correct word, by some revealing expressions of gutter race hatred of the lowest sort. Not only for the Negro race, although that's what we're going to concentrate on tonight, and we'll cover the others on other nights, they also hated Jews and Slavs, and as a whole, what they called the common man, or the masses. Marx wrote Engels on July the 30th, 1862, that, quote, the Jewish nigger, LaSalle, end quote, was fortunately leaving London toward the end of the week for his native Germany, adding, and I quote again, it is now absolutely clear to me that as both the shape of his head and his hair texture shows, he descends from the Negroes who joined Moses' flight from Egypt, unless his mother or grandmother on the paternal side hybridized with a nigger. Now, this combination of Germanness and Jewishness with a primarily Negro substance necessarily creates a strange product. The pushiness of the fellow is also nigger-like. End quote. Now, if you just tuned in, folks, I am quoting Karl Marx in a letter to Friedrich Engels that was written on July the 30th, 1862. Quite outside of the offensive tone of the letter, it illustrates Marx's tendency to twist and invent evidence to express the envy and hatred he felt for his successful contemporaries. Judging by surviving photographs, ladies and gentlemen, LaSalle rather closely approximated the German Nordic type. Marx, on the other hand, was so swarthy that he was called the Moor by acquaintances ever since university days. He had a thick, flattened nose. One observer described his complexion as dirty yellow. Nobody in his right mind would have thought Marx's physiognomy German. The official Prussian police report, a document which attempted accuracy for purposes of identification of suspects, reads, quote, special recognition signs, A, in his speech and appearance, reminds one somewhat of his Jewish origin. B, is clever, cold, and resolute. End quote. While he was certainly not a Negro type, Marx's appearance was more Negroid than LaSalle's ever could have been. Nor was there anything to Marx's theory that the Jews of the Exodus had hybridized with Negroes en route to the Holy Land. There were no Negroes in the area. Again, we have a case of Marx inventing historical theories for malicious purposes. Marx's speculation that LaSalle's ancestors had mated or intermarried with blacks was fanciful. The passage quoted is interesting both as an example of Marx's paranoid hatred of people, particularly Jews, who were conspicuously more successful than he was, and as a revelation of his secret loathing of the Negro race. Let's look at another example. On August 7th, 1866, Marx wrote Engels about an exciting discovery he had made. The find was a pompous and preposterous book by a French ethnologist and racist crackpot named Pierre Trémaux, which anyone well-versed in science and scientific method would have dismissed as total rubbish. Marx, however, hailed Trémaux's work as marking, quote, a very significant advance over Darwin, end quote. Marx's infatuation with Trémaux's race theories will be discussed in more detail on another night. Let's suffice it to say at this point that Marx wrote Engels that Trémaux had proved that the common Negro type is the degenerate form of a much higher one. Actually, Trémaux had proved nothing. He had made the extraordinary and, of course, unsubstantiated assertion that the Negro race was not a product of evolution, but of human degeneration. His actual words were, quote, the backward Negro is not an evolved ape, but a degenerate man, end quote. A finding that, in Marx's opinion, made Trémaux superior to Darwin, if you can imagine such a thing. Both of them were off the deep end. On October 2nd, 1866, Engels replied to one of Marx's enthusiastic letters about Trémaux with a long refutation of that charlatan's theories. At the moment, we are only concerned merely with what Engels had to say about Trémaux and Negroes. As before, when I used the word nigger, it means that Ingalls inserted the offensive English term into the German text of his letter. And for those of you who may be just tuning in, this is not my words, ladies and gentlemen. It is the words of Karl Marx in the correspondence between Karl Marx and his mentor, a very rich capitalist, Friedrich Engels. You see, I'm laying bare the lie, the socialist lie that Marx is some kind of hero. Marx was a dismal, abject failure at everything that he ever tried. He was jealous, resentful, and hated anyone who was successful. He created the social premise that the world owes somebody else everything, because that's the only way Marx could ever get anything. He lived his whole life off of the charity of Friedrich Engels. Now, here's what Marx had to say in his letter. The stories about the nigger, Santa Maria, and about the transformation of whites into Negroes are laughable. Namely, that the traditions of the Senegal niggers are worthy of unconditional belief precisely because the fellows don't know how to write. The way the fellow explains how we Rhinelanders, on our Devonian transitional rocks, which have not been underwater since long before the era of coal formation, did not become idiots and niggers. He will perhaps show us in his second volume, or else assert that we really are niggers. Another incident gives us a clue to Marx's true feelings and thoughts about Negroes. Marx's old patron, Charles Dana, approached him with the proposal that he write articles for an American encyclopedia. Marx was assigned subjects beginning with the letter B. This was a welcome source of income for the always debt-ridden and impecunious revolutionary who couldn't hold on to a job or a nickel and never made much in the jobs that he had. Marx wrote a violently intemperate biography of the liberator of Latin America, Simón Bolívar. Dana said that he was disturbed by its partisan tone and asked Marx to give his reference sources. On February 14, 1858, Marx wrote Engels about the matter. He considered Bolivar, quote, that coward, that vile and miserable swine. He added, Bolivar is a real Solecue. The reference was to Faustine Elie Solecue, a black former slave who through a combination of ruthlessness and native ability, had seized power in Haiti and had himself proclaimed Emperor Faustin I. Marx's second daughter, Laura, fell in love with a young medical student named Paul Lefargue in 1866. Lefargue was of French-Cuban origin. He was apparently one-quarter Jewish, one-quarter Carib Indian, probably less than an eighth Negro, and the rest French. Although Lefargue was a socialist and one of Marx's greatest admirers, Marx was not at all pleased. In fact, he was very angry with the proposed marriage until he discovered that the bridegroom-to-be was the only son of a wealthy West Indian planter whose father planned to settle a large sum on the couple. I can just see him now trying to figure out how to get his hands on a portion of the sum. This not only provided Laura with apparent financial security, ladies and gentlemen, but it opened up a new source from which Marx himself might borrow money. Marx decided that Lefargue was a handsome, intelligent, energetic, and gymnastically developed fellow with an exceptional talent for medicine. This is what he said publicly when his son-in-law was around. Lefargue's exceptional talent for medicine may seem dubious to us, since he believed that the main cures for disease were alcohol and electricity. He proposed Pasteur's discoveries and sent Marx articles that maintained that germs were spontaneously created, that Pasteur was wrong. Whether he was a potential medical genius or not, Lefargue, in due time, abandoned medicine for unsound business schemes and, of course, socialist politics. Lefargue seemed in many ways an ideal son-in-law. He was comparatively rich. He was a socialist. He was a man who ran political errands for Marx. He was a professional, and by Marx's standards, a coming man in medicine. Now, don't get all this wrong, folks. This did not prevent Marx from telling Theodore Kuno, a fellow socialist who was immigrating to the United States, that one of his daughters had contributed to, quote, solving the color question by marrying a nigger, end quote. In addition, Marx habitually referred to Lafargue as the little negro, negrillo, or as the gorilla. This was unadulterated race prejudice. Lafargue was a man of distinguished appearance and aristocratic bearing. Jenny von Westphalen, Marx, characterized Lafargue as a true nigger for whom, quote, the sky was always full of violins, end quote. That was Lafargue's sister-in-law, Marx's other daughter. Laura, Lafargue's wife, bore a second child a year after the first. On January the 17th, 1870, Jenny Marx wrote Ingalls that she hoped her daughter would practice reproductive restraint and not produce, quote, 10 little nigger boys, end quote. I have already quoted the unpleasant remark which Ingalls made in 1887, 3 years before his death, that it was highly appropriate for Lafargue to run for office in a Paris district that included the zoo, since, quote, in his quality as a nigger, end quote, he was, quote, a degree nearer to the animal kingdom than the rest of us, end quote. I bet there's a lot of socialists out there writhing around in their seat, gnashing their teeth. And it won't do you any good to deny this, because the original letters between Marx and Ingalls were preserved and reproduced in a book in the Soviet Union. And it's on record. I've already given you enough to throw the man right out with the dishwater, but I'm not going to stop here. I'm going to make sure that he's buried 6 feet under where he belongs. He belongs out of all of our hair. Most, if not all, ladies and gentlemen, of these insulting racial slurs were made by Marx and Ingalls behind the backs of Paul and Laura Lafargue. Whether this made them more excusable is for you to judge. In fairness to Ingalls, it should be pointed out that when the Lafargues lost their money, he supported them financially with numerous loans, just as he had supported Laura's father for most of his life. And later on, he supported the rest of the Marx family. Actually, the name wasn't Marx at all, as you'll learn later. Until his dying breath, you see, Ingalls supported Marx's children and grandchildren whenever they were in need, which was most of the time, just as he had supported Marx himself. You see, the world is going to base the government upon an abject failure who created all this socialism nonsense so that he could get something for nothing from all of those whom he envied and hated because of their success. And that's what socialism really appeals to. If you really examine the socialists that you know, you'll see that they're scared to death of life. They're afraid of life. They're not really successes at anything. And they've got to be supported. They've got to be taken care of. To put it very bluntly, somebody has to change their diapers constantly so that they can live in this world. Otherwise, according to the laws of nature, they would not. Marx and Ingalls, ladies and gentlemen, derived their belief that the Negro stood outside of history and was incapable of contributing to civilization from Hegel. You know Hegel. I've discussed him many times on this broadcast. And if you want really a true assessment of socialism, Hegel and all of these people who have brought this into the world, this vile philosophy into the world, read a book by Leonard Peikoff called Well, I'll tell you what. I'm not going to give you that right now. Because I want to talk about that at length on another night. We just may go back to Peacock and cover it in a lot more depth than we ever had before. Hegel did not, of course, descend to the mean and nasty abuse which characterized his two revolutionary followers, Marx and Engels. But what he had to say was harshly condemnatory and based on skimpy evidence. The gist of it was this, that the Negro, quote, exhibits the natural man in his completely wild and untamed state, end quote. He believed that the Negroes of Africa were incapable of religion, but were rather sorcerers who imagined that with their fetishes they could command the forces of nature. The Negro race, Hegel continues, has, and I quote, perfect contempt for humanity. Tyranny is regarded as no wrong, and cannibalism is looked upon as quite customary and proper. Parents sell their children, and conversely, children their parents, as either has the opportunity. The polygamy of the Negroes has frequently for its object the having of many children to be sold, every one of them, into slavery, and very often naive complaints on this score are heard, as for instance in the case of a Negro in London who lamented that he was now quite a poor man because he had already sold all his relations. Slavery is in and for itself injustice, for the essence of humanity is freedom. But for this, man must be matured. The gradual abolition of slavery is therefore wiser and more equitable than its sudden removal. At this point, we leave Africa, not to mention it again, for it is no historical part of the world. It has no movement or development to exhibit, end quote. Now, Marx and Engels apparently accepted Hegel's conclusions about the relationship of the Negro world to civilization, although they obviously did not relate the ahistoric condition of the Negro world to a lack of consciousness of God. Hegel himself is unclear, and probably deliberately so, about the reasons for the Negro being frozen, as he sees it, in the savage and brutish state of natural man. Marx, ladies and gentlemen, actually championed Negro slavery. He spent a large part of his life writing diatribes against fellow revolutionaries who had the impudence to differ with him. When Pierre-Joseph Proudhon, probably the leading socialist thinker in France at the time, published a book called The Philosophy of Poverty, Marx immediately replied with a vitriolic rebuttal entitled The Poverty of Philosophy, 1847. Proudhon had been childish enough to advocate the emancipation of the Negro slaves in the United States, and Marx answered contemptuously with this, quote, without slavery, North America, the most progressive of countries, would be transformed into a patriarchal country. Wipe out North America from the map of the world, and you will have anarchy, the complete decay of modern commerce and civilization. Abolish slavery, and you will have wiped America off the map of nations. End quote. What Marx was saying, ladies and gentlemen, in effect, was that the Negro slaves were needed to produce raw cotton. Cotton was the basic raw material of modern capitalist industry. Therefore, Negro slavery was necessary to the survival of America and to the survival of modern civilization. The first thing that is interesting about the quoted paragraph is that Marx again makes it abundantly clear that he has no interest whatsoever in the fate or welfare of Negroes. Never did. He hated them. The second point of interest is his preposterous predictions. If slavery were abolished, America would become a patriarchal country. What does that mean? A nation of primitive shepherds? Perhaps like the tribes of the Old Testament patriarchs? Evidently, Marx actually believed that emancipation would wipe America off the map of the world. America would cease to exist as a nation. For a reasonably well-educated man to make this sort of a judgment in the year 1847 is absolutely incomprehensible. Alexis de Tocqueville had published his great work on the United States called Democracy in America between 1835 and 1840. Marx could have read there, we don't know if he did or not, but he could have, quote, "The inhabitants of the United States constitute a great civilized people, which fortune has placed in the midst of an uncultivated country, at a distance of 3,000 miles from the central point of civilization. America consequently stands in daily need of European trade. The American will, no doubt, ultimately succeed in producing or manufacturing at home most of the things which they require, but the two continents can never be independent of each other. So numerous are the natural ties which exist between their wants, their ideas, their habits, and their manners." Here, Marx's prediction that the United States would become a patriarchal society with de Tocqueville's more or less contemporary view of the American future. And I quote again, "There are, at the present time, two great nations in the world which seem to tend toward the same end, although they started from different points. I allude to the Russians and the Americans. Both of them have grown up unnoticed, and whilst the attention of mankind was directed elsewhere, they have suddenly assumed a most pronounced place amongst the nations, and the world learned their existence and their greatness at almost the same time. All other nations seem to have nearly reached their natural limits and only to be charged with the maintenance of their power. But these two are still in the act of growth. All the others are stopped or continue to advance with extreme difficulty. These are proceeding with ease and with celerity along a path to which the human eye can assign no term. The American struggles against the natural obstacles which oppose him. The adversaries of the Russian are men. The former combats the wildness and savage life, the latter civilization with all its weapons and its arts. The conquests of the one are therefore gained by the plowshare, those of the other by the sword. The Anglo-American relies upon personal interest to accomplish his ends and gives free scope to the unguided exertions and common sense of the citizens. The Russian centers all the authority of society in a single arm. The principal instrument of the former is freedom, of the latter servitude. Their starting point is different, and their courses are not the same. Yet each of them seems to be marked out by the will of heaven to sway the destinies of half the globe." End quote. Can you imagine that Alexis de Tocqueville said that in 1835, between 1835 and 1840? And it's still that way today, ladies and gentlemen. And the greatest conflict that is raging in the world is between the philosophy of freedom in America and of servitude in Russia. Even now, he called it. He called it at that time. And it is true today. This contrast in prophecy speaks for itself, and it absolutely needs no commentary. Ladies and gentlemen, the hour of the time is brought to you by Swiss America Trading. The people in Phoenix who care enough about this country and about all of us to back this broadcast, they pay for all the airtime. I don't take a penny from them or anyone else for this broadcast, because it has to stay clean, and clean it is. This is not a source of income for us. Swiss America cares about the message, and make no mistake about it. I have been for many years a messenger. I am a messenger tonight, and barring some failure of my will or courage, which I don't foresee, I'll still be a messenger tomorrow night. You know, even if you never feel the need to get your hands on some real money, you should just call Swiss America Trading and thank them for sponsoring this broadcast. Do you know that most sponsors would have quit the night they burned down WWCR when I was broadcasting from Waco, Texas, and telling the world that unless we stopped what was happening there, the government fully intended to murder all of those people in that church. And I was right. Because I was right, that very night they burned down WWCR to the ground. And they were off the air for several weeks. Swiss America Trading, instead of bailing out like most sponsors would, immediately found me another station to broadcast on. Made the arrangements, paid the money, and we were back on the air within 24 hours. That's the kind of people that make up Swiss America Trading. They understand what's happening. They understand what's coming. And they're in the right business to help all of us. They are also, ladies and gentlemen, the only ones who do these certain things. Number one, they have a guarantee. They guarantee what they do, and I stand behind that guarantee. I guarantee it also. Craig Smith and I have an understanding that people are going to be treated right by Swiss America Trading, and if they don't feel they're treated right, they can call me, and I will perform an investigation and get to the bottom of it. I'll find out. You see, because everything is taped, it's on tape, ladies and gentlemen. You can't lie about what you said or about what the salespeople at Swiss America said, because it's on tape. And about 3 or 4 days after you reach an agreement and you've paid your money, before they even send any of the product that you have purchased to you, they call you again and go over the terms of the agreement to make sure that there was no misunderstanding, and that phone call is taped. And they go even further than that, ladies and gentlemen. They have a buyback policy. You know what that means? That means that if you purchased $20,000 worth of merchandise from Swiss America Trading, and the very next day the bottom fell out of the commodities market all the way down to zero, they will buy everything that you have back if you want to sell it back to them at the prearranged buyback price. And they take the loss, not you. Now, if you really, really believe that you can get better people, a better company, better guarantees than all of that, then go to it. But if you want to deal with people who are reputable, who back what they do, and who have a buyback policy and guarantees, and tape everything so there can be no misunderstandings, and who I back solidly, because whoever's tied to this broadcast is tied to me. So they can't sponsor this broadcast if I can't sponsor them. That's the way I do things. So call Swiss America Trading. Ask them how you can get your hands on some real money. Protect at least a portion of your assets against what is coming. And while you're at it, thank them for sponsoring this broadcast, because if they weren't there, chances are we wouldn't be in your living room or wherever your radio is at tonight. 1-800-289-2646. That's 1-800-289-2646. You'll be glad that you did. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, did you know that not only did Marx hate Negroes, blacks, whom he called niggers, idiots, but he hated Slavs. He hated what he called the common men, or the masses, the great stupid herd of animals, as he referred to them. But he also hated his own people. You see, Marx was a Jew, and he hated Jews with a passion. There are few aspects of Karl Marx's character that are more contemptible than his ferocious attacks on Jews and on Judaism at a time when anti-Semitism was still rife in Europe and massacres of Jews were a recent memory. Although Marx was of pure Jewish descent on both sides, he consistently repudiated or was silent concerning his origin. As Sir Isaiah Berlin puts it, quote, "The fact that he was a Jew, neither he nor Engels ever mentions. His references to individual Jews, particularly in his letters to Engels, are virulent to a degree. His origin had become a personal stigma which he was unable to avoid pointing out in others." End quote. You see, this man was sick. Karl Marx was mentally ill. He was destitute of spirit. It's almost as if he had no soul. And maybe he didn't. The socialist custodians of Marx's hate-brimmed correspondence suppressed or embellished those letters which cast their hero in an unsavory light. They eliminated the language of gutter anti-Semitism, which came so naturally to both Marx and Engels. You see, the history of socialism is mostly a fraud, a counterfeit. They never tell the truth about anything. And they all know that they're lying. I don't even know how they can live with each other or look each other in the eye. Let's consider one example. Ferdinand LaSalle, the German Jewish leader of the German socialist and labor movement, had at all times done whatever he could to help Marx and to promote Marx's books. While professing friendship for LaSalle, Marx would secretly characterize him as, quote, "the little kike," end quote, or, quote, "Ephraim Smart," end quote, or, quote, "a shameless beast," end quote, "a pompous ape, and a water Polak Jew," end quote. On March 7, 1856, Engels wrote Marx on the same subject, declaring that LaSalle was nothing but a greasy Jew from Breslau, who has always been repulsive to me. We owe this unvarnished text to the integrity of the Soviet scholar David Ryazanov, who managed to get the four volumes of Marx-Engels correspondence off the presses before Stalin had him expelled from the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. And so it's all been preserved exactly as they were written. But the Marx-Engels letters had been in the hands of the German Social Democratic Party for a whole generation. The editors were August Bebel and Eduard Bernstein, the latter a Jew. How had they handled this editorial problem? They had simply expurgated or eliminated the things Marx and Engels wrote that might offend the national or racial pride of those groups of fools that their party wanted to manipulate. As for Engels' letter of March 7th, 1856, the only one of these anti-Jewish tirades that we've checked out in both editions, they resorted to the simple expedient of eliminating it. Thus, these people claimed to be scientific socialists and who were quick to cast slurs on the integrity of the bourgeois scholars engaged in a systematic falsification of evidence, which they continue to this day. They are barefaced, chronic, shameful liars. Always have been, and they show no evidence that they will ever be anything but liars. What was involved was much more than the feelings of Jewish socialists. You see, Marx's phobia toward Jews was extremely significant on several levels. The first was pathological. To rise above one's origins is one thing. We all admire that. To spew hatred, contempt, and loathing on them suggests a deep-seated disturbance and has resulted in several attempts to understand Marx in terms of, quote, Jewish self-hate, end quote. He was mentally ill, ladies and gentlemen. This man was a psychotic who developed a philosophy that is about to engulf the world. The second area of significance was that the correspondence makes it abundantly plain that Marx and Engels were not internationalists, but racists. The third area is that these race hatreds were not confined to Jews, but spilled over with venomous detestation on Negroes, Slavs, and many others. Finally, the correspondence, viewed as a whole and in its unexpurgated condition, is filled with fierce vituperation against almost everyone who failed to kowtow to Marx on all occasions. Strangely enough, the so-called secret conversations of Adolf Hitler are less suffused with hatred and destruction than Marx's contributions to the Marx-Engels correspondence. Perhaps the explanation of this anomaly is that Hitler was able to express his total destructiveness in action by waging a war in which millions would perish, by driving 6 million Jews into gas ovens, and by inflicting death by overwork and starvation on millions of Slavs and other Russians. Whereas Marx and Engels were impotent. Impotent. They merely dreamed of catastrophic wars. They could only condemn whole peoples to eradication in their imagination. And that's why I tell you, and I know this to be a fact, when world socialism comes to power, they will eliminate the Negro race, and most probably the Hispanic race, whom they call, in their private correspondence, useless eaters. I made this statement in my book years ago. The official biography of Marx by Franz Mehring has no index listing under either anti-Semitism or Jews. There's a brief section on Marx's notorious essay on the Jewish question, in which Mehring inaccurately summarizes Marx's conclusion as, quote, practical Judaism is nothing but the fully developed Christian world, end quote. A more recent Marxist scholar, David McClellan, assures us, quote, it is largely this article that has given the impression that Marx was an anti-Semite. This is inaccurate. Judentum, the German word for Judaism, had the derivative meaning of commerce, and it is this meaning which is uppermost in Marx's mind throughout the article, end quote. What McClellan is saying, in essence, is that all Marx meant was that he regarded practical Judaism as the highest expression of capitalism. Consequently, the emancipation of the Jews involved the abolition of this practical Judaism. That is to say, the abolition of capitalism. This is an ingenious explanation, but it does not stand up against the evidence, ladies and gentlemen. It, in fact, is a fabrication. Another lie. The first point to make is that Marx expressed his aversion to Judaism before he became a communist, and at a time when he publicly opposed both socialism and communism. While he was editor of Die Reichszeitung, the leaders of the Cologne Jewish community asked him to support their petition for equal civil rights with Christians. Marx wrote Arnold Ruge on March 13, 1843, that he had decided to do so in order to, quote, puncture as many holes as possible in the Christian state, end quote. He would do so even though he found, quote, the Israelite religion widerlich, end quote. Padover translates the German word widerlich as, quote, revolting, repulsive, loathsome, and nauseating, end quote. Marx's essay on the Jewish question that has received the unstinted praise of Mehring and the bland apologetics of McLellan is in reality one of the most violent and mindless attacks on Jews and Judaism of the 19th century. Marx thunders, quote, "What is the secular basis of Judaism? Practical need, self-interest. What is the worldly cult of the Jew? Haggling. What is his worldly god? Money. Money is the jealous god of Israel before whom no other god may exist. Money degrades all the gods of mankind and converts them into commodities. What is contained abstractly in the Jewish religion? Contempt for theory, for art, for history, for man as an end in himself. The social emancipation of the Jew is the emancipation of society from Jewishness," end quote. Now, how much more anti-Semitic can you get? If this hymn of hate had been penned by a man utterly ignorant of Judaism and of Jewish culture, it might have been explained away as due to the prevalent prejudices of the time. But Marx knew from his own background, family ambience, and lineage that the charges he had made were lies. A large number of his ancestors and at least one of his uncles had been rabbis. Some of them, ladies and gentlemen, distinguished scholars. Did he sincerely believe that these theologians had contempt for theory? I think not. Did he imagine that a people that had written the Bible had contempt for history? I seriously doubt it. And if the nature of Jewishness was haggling and money worship, how did he reconcile this fact with the sacrifices his own family had made to provide him with that education and culture which, according to Marx, they must have despised? At the time this vitriolic essay was published, over half the Jews in the Rhineland made their livelihood as artisans and craftsmen. How could they hate art? But Marx had not, of course, bothered to ascertain these facts any more than he had taken the trouble to read anything about Jewish religion or Jewish history, except for a few anti-Semitic outbursts by Bruno Bauer. This condemnation of his own origin, his own cultural heritage, and the religion of his ancestors was published by Marx at a time when pogroms still occurred. When the Jews were falsely accused, as the early Christians had been accused, of performing human sacrifices in their religious rites. Bet you didn't know that the Christians were accused of the same thing in their early history. In short, it was an incitement not only to religious and racial intolerance, but also to genocide. We do not know, ladies and gentlemen, whether any of the people who herded cringing Jewish women and children into Hitler's labor camps and ovens had read Marx's On the Jewish Question. But it is safe to say that if they had, it would have encouraged them in their activities. Goethe once said, "I am always astounded at the malevolence of little people." Karl Marx never wrote another article about Jews or Judaism, but he remained an active anti-Semite until his dying breath. The hatred he bore for his people exuded out of him on the most inappropriate occasions, like pus from an infected wound, like popping a boil on your butt. Consider the case of Moses Hess. Hess was the man who had hailed Marx as his idol and as a philosopher who combined the wisdom and wit of Rousseau, Voltaire, Heine, and Hegel. He'd also converted both Engels and Marx to socialism. Under the circumstances, Marx might have been expected to treat Hess with at least outward respect and decency. But on September 22, 1856, Marx hurried to inform Engels of some gossip he had heard about Moses and Sibyl Hess, which placed them in a discreditable and ridiculous light. According to Marx, Sibyl Hess, whom he always referred to as Mosen, presumably the feminine form of Moses, had been seduced by an impecunious Russian named Sasanov. This fellow was, quote, much in tatters, very much without cash or credit, and consequently open to plebeian and revolutionary and world-storming ideas, end quote. Moses Hess had introduced Sasanov to the right salons and advanced him the money he needed. And then, Marx wrote, Sasanov enticed a rich old Jewess and took her in kosher wedlock. But he abandoned Mosin faithlessly, and she is now running around Paris scolding and howling, and tells everyone who will listen to her about the treachery of the perfidious Muscovite. This is certainly the story of the grandeur and decadence of the House of Moses. End quote. 4 days later, Ingalls replied, saying that, quote, the stories about Moses and Moisin made us laugh a good deal around here, end quote. Many years later, Jenny von Westphalen died, and Sybil Hess, now widowed, wrote Karl Marx, quote, ach, what a terrible surprise when I read the death notice of your dear wife written by our gallant Ingalls. I first learned to love and to appreciate her when we all lived together in Brussels, and from that time on she has remained in my memory full of love and reverence. I find it impossible to describe to you how deeply the news has shaken me. End quote. In his thesis on Feuerbach, 1845, Marx comments that Feuerbach considers practical human activity, quote, only in its dirty Jewish form of appearance, end quote. Comments of this sort are scattered all throughout his writings. Good night, ladies and gentlemen. We'll continue this tomorrow night. And God bless you all.
Dear comrades and friends, I hope that this time my voice will reach you and that I will be permitted in his way to participate in your total celebration. Both events, the 10th anniversary of our American organization, as well as the Foundation Congress of the Fourth International, deserve the attention of the workers incomparably more than the warlike gestures of the totalitarian chiefs, the diplomatic intrigues for the pacifist congresses. Both events will enter history as important milestones. No one has now the right to doubt that. It is necessary to remark that the birth of the American group of Bolshevik Leninists, thanks to the courageous initiative of comrades Kennan, Schachtman, and Abern, didn't stand alone. It approximately coincided with the beginning of the systematic international work of the left opposition. It is true that the left opposition arose in Russia in 1923, 15 years ago, but regular work on an international scale began with the 6th Congress of the Comintern. Without a personal meeting, we reached an agreement with the American pioneers of the 4th International, before all on the criticism of the program of the Communist International. Then, in 1928, began the collective work which after 10 years led to the elaboration of our own program recently adopted by our international conference. We have the right to say that the work in this decade was not only persistent and patient, but also honest. The Bolshevik Leninists, the international pioneers,